Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. And from Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Following the rearrest of a Pensacola lab analyst for tampering with drug evidence, changes will soon be in store for much of Florida's drug crime lab operations.
By instilling these enhanced inspection procedures and the randomness of them, I think it's going to take us a long way and give us the further assurance that we need.
Also tonight, we get the latest Florida jobless figures and tourism numbers. The latter is really looking good.
We are really having a tremendous year. In April, set a record in bed tax collections. Most bed tax collected in any month since we've been tracking bed tax.
We'll also talk about the sudden resurgence of farming in Florida, learn about a new way of recycling water for those farms, and hear about a lawsuit involving elected officials using blind trusts to hold their assets. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. In the coming months, there will be some major shifts in the way statewide crime labs operate. As Sasha Cordner reports, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement is looking to make some procedural changes spurred on by the initial arrest of a former crime lab chemist in a supervisory role who's suspected of tampering with drug evidence.
Back in February, the news broke that hundreds of drug cases under the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's purview might have been compromised. During that time, FDLE Commissioner Gerald Bailey held a news conference about the agency's investigation into the missing prescription drugs.
Because of this breach, we have a lot of work to do to restore the confidence of our colleagues and of the Florida public. Our first priority is to find out exactly what happened in this particular case and work with the state attorneys to hold this person criminally accountable. Our second priority is to review lab protocols to ensure that this does not happen again.
Investigators soon determined that Joseph Grays, a supervisor at FDLE's accredited Pensacola crime lab, had overseen the cases in question. Grays resigned his position and was later arrested for replacing drug evidence with over-the-counter meds. He was charged with grand theft, 12 counts of tampering with or fabricating evidence, and 9 counts of trafficking in illegal drugs. Since 2006, Graves handled about 2,600 cases for 80 law enforcement agencies in more than half the counties in the state. So after further investigation, he was rearrested in early May with 41 additional counts. And Bill Eddins says that's understandable with so many jurisdictions involved. Eddins is a state attorney for the 1st Judicial Circuit in the Panhandle area, whose office is also prosecuting the case.
Law enforcement jurisdictions from the 1st Circuit, which is the western part of the Panhandle, the four western counties, Escambia, Santa Rosa, Okaloosa, and Walton. In addition, it covered the 14th Circuit, including Jackson County, Bay County is Panama City, and Jackson is Mariana. Also included a count from Franklin County, which is Apalachicola. Sewanee County had several counts that were added, and Pasco County, which is north of Tampa, had several. Sumter County had some, and there were some other jurisdictions as well.
Eddins says while the investigation is still ongoing, he doesn't expect any more new charges, and adds it could be months before an actual trial takes place.
He normally would have an arraignment on these new charges in about 3 weeks. A standard procedure would be to enter a not guilty plea, which we anticipate, and it will be several months before the discovery is completed and the matter is ready for trial because of the large number of cases involved, as well as the diverse and spread out jurisdiction and agencies that are involved.
Since his recent arrest, Graves remains in jail with a bond of just over $1 million. Meanwhile, the arrest has called FDLE's drug crime lab operations into question. And agency spokeswoman Gretel Plessinger says the inspector general did a review of the lab system and made some recommendations.
So some of the changes that they recommended are new packaging to include a description of submitted items and the requirement that pharmaceutical drugs be packaged in clear bags. There were also some limits to forensic vault access and with members with evidence intake duties, and to prohibit lab analysts who work on cases from assigning cases to themselves.
Essentially, FDLE Commissioner Gerald Bailey says to get to where they need to be,
we're going to start from zero.
Bailey says overall these changes are important not just for the safety of the general public, but for lab employees as well.
It is just one guy and one lab and one section, but still, that I don't want to demean the significance of this. The morale hit with all our forensics has been rough because they've enjoyed the reputation that they have. And if you had the ability to see our two people that testified in the Zimmerman trial, you'll see that they deserve that reputation.
Bailey is also looking into more scrutiny in the crime lab operations, such as random inspections. The changes are expected to take effect July 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Tourism marketers in Florida are hoping to see at least 100 million trips to the state this year. Janelle Irwin from member station WMNF in Tampa reports the latest numbers are out for the first quarter, and those figures were record-breaking.
The announcement Thursday at Busch Gardens by Visit Florida was heralded by Governor Rick Scott as a huge win for Floridians.
And think about it, we want more jobs in our state. Tourism is a big driver. When people come here as tourists, they buy homes, they buy cars, they say, man, this is a nice place to live, low crime rate. So in the first quarter of this year, we had record tourism numbers, 26.7 million tourists.
And as a man who considers himself the jobs governor, Scott points out the impact more tourism has on job creation.
Every 85 tourists is another job.
That means more than 1 million jobs were sustained in Florida between January and March because of tourism. Visit Tampa Bay's Santiago Corrada says the tourism boost is showing in Tampa, too.
We are really having a tremendous year. In April, set a record in bed tax collections, most bed tax collected in any month since we've been tracking bed tax.
Pinellas County also posted the highest tourism ever for the month of March. Beaches are Pinellas's bread and butter, but a recent climate change report released by the White House shows that sea level rise may be threatening coastal areas more than previous predictions. WMNF asked Governor Scott what he planned to do to mitigate sea level rise.
Well, we've been working, first off, in the last 3 years, we worked with our Division of Emergency Management and focused on flooding around our coast. We put $130 million in it, but we've done a variety of things to make sure we deal with anything that's happening, whether it's the Everglades settlement, historic, and all the investments we have, the investments, especially this year around the Indian River Lagoon. We're making strategic investments to deal with anything.
Last question, waterfront property in Naples. Do you worry about your property with rising sea levels at all?
No. I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you what, we're going to make sure we continue to make the right investments in the state. Take care of our environment. We love living here.
Scott's answer about the Everglades and Indian River Lagoon projects deal with water quality issues, not sea level rise. In the White House report, the Tampa Bay area, as well as Miami and Apalachicola, are listed as some of the most at-risk cities for increased flooding. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Janelle Irwin in Tampa.
There was some positive news on the Florida jobs front today, and it was moderately good news for Governor Rick Scott. The governor has made job creation the core of his reelection bid, and the state's jobless rate in April did go down, but just by a smidgen. April's rate was 6.2%. That's down 0.1% from March, but essentially the same as it was in February. Still, it was way better than April of last year, when the Florida unemployment rate was a hefty 7.6%. Even better than that, said the governor, was that the state created more than 33,000 private sector jobs. However, figures from the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity show joblessness tended to be lower in counties with greater concentrations of public sector workers. Northwest Florida's Walton County had the lowest unemployment rate in April at 3.2%. On the other end of the scale, Southwest Florida's Hendry County had the highest unemployment rate in April at 8.4%. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida is experiencing a farmland boom. A new census shows the state with more farms than it's had since the 1950s.
There's also a huge amount of people who are retiring that are getting into farming, which isn't changing that median age, but it is, the number of new farmers has increased a lot.
A new method of cleaning stormwater runoff could literally change Florida's relationship with water.
50 to 60% of the nitrates are removed and about 64% of the phosphates are removed.
And we asked, what would Askew do? The late governor and champion of the state's open record laws is being invoked in a fight over whether blind trust can be used in place of financial reporting. The Florida Department of Children and Families has appointed its first statewide fatality prevention specialist, a position created by the department's new interim secretary, Mike Carroll, earlier this month. Lisa Rivera, a 17-year DCF veteran, started today in the Office of Child Welfare. She'll oversee the department's reporting, data gathering, and response to child fatalities. Rivera has a master's degree in social work from the University of South Florida. She started at DCF as a child protective investigator and most recently served as the child fatality prevention specialist for DCF's Suncoast region, the region where Carroll has worked previously. He said, "We're committed to improving our response, consistency, and transparency," in a statement. Lisa has the experience and expertise to lead this effort and engage communities in protecting children from abuse and neglect. Rivera also has a background in domestic violence issues. Before working for DCF, she supervised a domestic violence center in Honolulu, where she also helped develop a curriculum to address the traumatic effects of family violence on children. She now provides advanced domestic violence training to the Child Protective Investigation staff of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. For the first time in more than 30 years, Florida is gaining acres of farmland rather than losing them. But as more areas are planted or devoted to livestock, the average age of farmers has gone up. As Jessica Palumbo reports, some in the local food movement are working to break down barriers keeping new farmers from getting into the game.
It's drop-off day for farmers who belong to Tallahassee's Red Hills Online Market. Turkey Hill farm owner Louise Devine is unloading orders customers placed through the group's website over the past few days.
This week there's kale and shiitake mushrooms and shallots.
The market started about 4 years ago, connecting growers within 100 miles of the city directly with customers who will pick up the produce and meat here or have it delivered to their homes.
Lettuces, tomatoes, we are strong in tomatoes. Tomatoes are just beginning.
100% grass-fed ground beef.
We have some folks that do honey, we have folks that do beef, pecans, lamb.
The online market has been so successful that the drop-off point had to move out of the back of a food co-op and into its own warehouse last month. Co-manager Katie Harris says it's helped her 5-year-old Gadsden County farm be able to grow from 2 acres to a planned 5 acres.
You know, I can be at the beach, you know, having a great time and be at the farmer's market at the same time. So that's a big deal. Gives us a little boost in the middle of the week.
Harris says the direct line to customers overcomes a problem small-time operations have when they don't produce enough volume to be carried in large supermarkets. And just as the market has steadily added farms over the past 5 years, a new national agricultural census shows Florida now has more farms operating than it has since the early 1950s, adding farmland in almost two-thirds of its counties since 2007.
In Florida, if you get in your car and drive, I would imagine in 10 minutes you can be to a farm anywhere in the state.
That's Florida Department of Agriculture researcher Dan Sleep. He says the past decade or so had been rough on agriculture, but things are rebounding now.
We could almost anticipate growth in farms should have probably been pinched downward, but it didn't. So they're resilient, they're learning, they're getting better.
But online market manager Harris says wannabe farmers still face an uphill battle.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing for people getting into farming is land access. Owning land is is easy for people who have, you know, have had a career and have money and have capital and all these things. But for young people, they don't have that.
Just ask Claire Mitchell. The not-yet 30-year-old and her business partner own a successful Tallahassee urban farm supplying produce to 13 restaurants. It's their livelihood. But the plot of land they planted doesn't belong to them, and a bank is selling it, so they're shutting down this summer.
There's no help, really. There's no governmental help of, you know, maybe linking up young farmers and beginning farmers with land, or having some kind of financial loan programs or micro-grant programs to get young farmers started. And also, where a young farmer is going to learn how to do this anyway.
As the census shows, the average age of a farmer has risen slightly to 60. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Of course, farms and just about everything else depend heavily on the availability of clean water. Back before this year's lawmaking session, we talked a lot about water here on Capitol Report. There were multiple bills in the legislative hopper to reverse the deterioration of the state's springs, protect wetlands, and keep pollutants out of the Floridan aquifer. However, it wasn't long into the session that the political will to tackle these issues seemed to dry up as quickly as an inch-deep puddle in July. Now, as Ryan Bank reports, a Tallahassee scientist is hoping to promote better water quality and bridge a political divide at the same time.
At the outset of the 2014 Florida legislative session, political will to try and solve the state's most pressing water issues seemed to flow freely. Lawmakers on both sides of the political divide submitted measures to increase funding for a swath of local water projects, but perhaps the most expansive proposal came from Altamont Springs Republican Senator David Simmons. He spearheaded a bipartisan effort to pass a far-reaching bill that would have increased regulation of some of the state's more sickly springs, streams, rivers, and aquifers. Senators eventually passed Simmons' measure without a single no vote. But strong opposition from agricultural interests, who said the new rules would burden local ag businesses, effectively killed the bill in the House. Talk of comprehensive springs legislation dried up, at least for now. A failure to reconcile the agriculture industry's interests with environmental sustainability is nothing new, and it most certainly isn't unique to the Sunshine State. But one Florida A&M University scientist doesn't think a solution to the problem necessarily needs to come from the Capitol. Jennifer Charrier's been working with water for a couple of decades now. Originally from Connecticut, she moved to teach at FAMU. And while there, she began working on a project focusing on rain gardens, shallow depressions embedded with deep-rooted native plants for water collection.
They came to me in 2006 at FAMU and wanted us to install the first demonstration rain garden in Tallahassee. So the first demonstration rain garden that was installed in Tallahassee is on FAMU campus.
A couple years later, Charrier reviewed a very interesting dissertation submitted by one of her students, an idea to update the traditional rain garden. The plan was to leverage a rain garden's water collection power to create a system that not only stored rainwater and runoff, but filtered it and made it available for reuse. Charrier wanted to begin researching the plan immediately, and eventually she found a farm willing to let her build a test site, Clinton Nursery, in Havana, Florida.
You should see this place during when all the birds migrate. And, I mean, there is such a array of herons, egrets, storks.
Sheila J. Miner's been working at the more than 300-acre Havana nursery for years. She's touring around the grounds along narrow dirt roads in a large four-door pickup truck. Dotting the landscape were retention ponds, some massive, some reminiscent of puddles. She stops at the far right corner of the property, where three small planted depressions sat downhill from a large row of plants punctuating them. Staring at her pet project, Jennifer Charrier describes how research from this prototype is coming up with some very interesting results.
Well, 50 to 60% of the nitrates are removed and about 64% of the phosphates are removed.
And so how does that compare to the traditional way of storing and irrigating these?
Well, otherwise, the whole 100% nitrate would go and the whole 100% phosphate would go off the property and go into this adjacent forest.
What's more, Charrier says the project isn't only effective, but is also cheaper than more traditional ways for farmers to capture the runoff in rainwater, 75% cheaper. And she says those savings are even larger once combined with the added benefit of reusing water, using less land for retention ponds, and a filtration system that's far healthier for the environment. Clinton Nursery farmer Sheila J. Miner says that makes the project a win-win for everyone, agricultural and environmental advocates alike.
The science, the art, and the skill all come together as one, and it's reflected in the quality of the plants. You know, we're trying to keep the business going. You know, it's very tough for any business right now.
Although Jeminer says more established agricultural operations like Clinton Nursery can't rely solely on Charrier's now commercialized water system, many new farms could. And even older ones could always use the method to supplement their existing operations. Meanwhile, Charrier is working on making her system more scalable and is installing versions of it around the country, including New York City. Still, as much as she's happy about what her project might mean for environmental science, Charrier says she's more excited about the possibility of two disparate political rivers meeting in the middle to make a difference in Florida's environment. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
A Jacksonville attorney has asked the Florida Supreme Court to quickly take up an appeal in a dispute about whether a Northeast Florida judicial vacancy should be filled by appointment or by voters. Attorney David Trotty planned to run this year for a 4th Judicial Circuit position now held by Circuit Judge Donald Moran Jr. But Moran sent a letter to Governor Rick Scott back on March 26th, giving notice he'd resign this coming January 2nd. Scott accepted the resignation, which the State Division of Elections said would lead to Scott appointing a replacement rather than the seat being on the ballot this year. But Trotty, on the 29th of April, filed a petition with the Supreme Court, arguing that the judgeship should be filled by election. An election can and should be held to find a successor to Moran, the petition said. The appointment process is simply unnecessary in this circumstance. There's no emergency or public business requiring appointment, and therefore an appointment should not occur. Trotty's attorneys followed up on Thursday of this week by asking the Supreme Court to consider the appeal in an expedited manner. You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, open government advocates are asking, what would Ask You do when it comes to public officials and financial reporting? The late Governor Reuben Ask You promoted government transparency. And as Lynn Hatter reports, a lawsuit filed before the Florida Supreme Court says when public officials use blind trust to hide their assets, it's unconstitutional.
The Florida Supreme Court is asking Secretary of State Ken Detzner to respond to a lawsuit challenging the use of blind trusts by candidates and publicly elected officials, including Governor Rick Scott. Detzner is in charge of administering the state's campaign finance laws, and the court wants him to weigh in. In a letter sent to Detzner, Scott's campaign says the governor will comply with whatever the court decides, because Scott is the only current elected official whose assets are in a blind trust.
Our view is that Governor Scott behaved himself in a way that was consistent with a person trying to get good legal advice.
That's former Florida State University president and former head of the American Bar Association, Sandy Dallenbert, who filed the lawsuit. Dallenbert says the governor is not a target, though he would be affected by the case. Scott rolled his assets into a blind trust in 2011 after getting advice from lawyers and clearance from the State Ethics Commission.
He went to good lawyers. They gave him, in our judgment, bad advice, because we don't think that a blind trust can ever be full and public disclosure.
Dallenbert filed the lawsuit on behalf of Jim Apthorpe, former chief of staff to the late Governor Reuben Askew, who championed the state's Sunshine Amendment and pushed for more open government. Apthorpe helped write the amendment, and he says the idea behind blind trust is at odds with the financial reporting laws his former boss championed.
The purpose of a blind trust is to shield the office holder
from any indication that they might be guiding and directing the investments in that trust. So it becomes invisible to the person who set up the trust. But unfortunately, the way the law works today, it also becomes invisible to the public.
Blind trusts help public officials avoid conflict of interest allegations by allowing them to distance themselves from their investments. If a policy they champion affects their income, the candidate may not know about it, since the trust is also administered by another party. Other state officials have used blind trusts over the years. Before Scott, it was former Chief Financial Officer Alex Sink. Her assets were held in a blind trust during her time in office. In 2013, the state legislature gave bipartisan support to a bill codifying the Ethics Commission decision on blind trusts. The lawsuit is asking the Florida Supreme Court for an injunction to that law before the qualifying period for candidates ends July 16th. It's aimed at forcing candidates and publicly elected officials to fully disclose their assets. And according to the petition, the law creates confusion and, quote, many candidates may believe erroneously that filing a blind trust will satisfy the constitutional mandate. But if a blind trust has been a problem for so long, many are wondering why it's taken so long for something to be done about it. Dallenbert says no one was really paying attention to the issue until after the 2013 law was passed.
And then we began to think about upcoming election in 2014, which would be the first general election since the 2013 statute passed. And so it took us a while to pull all this together.
Florida's Sunshine Amendment and the state's open record laws are based on one main principle: the public has a right to know. And that right, say the lawsuit supporters, extend to the financial side of the issue, which means that those candidates and officials have to disclose their assets every year.
The Constitution Amendment says you'll list every asset over $1,000.
Joining the lawsuit are several media outlets, including the Florida Press Association, the Associated Press, the Miami Herald, and the Florida Times Union. The First Amendment Foundation has also signed on as well, and so has the Florida League of Women Voters. The groups are asking, what would Ask You do? League spokeswoman Erin Jensen held up the late governor's efforts to fight corruption in the 1970s.
We salute the vision of Governor Ask You, who ensured that Florida would lead the way into a future of full public disclosure. And we are dedicated to ensuring that transparency in government and measurable steps towards progress are protected and enforced.
The Florida Supreme Court wants the Secretary of State's office to respond to the merits of the lawsuit, whether the court has jurisdiction to hear it or if it should be sent to a circuit court. The response is due Wednesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. And from Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.